thing because there's no clock in the back.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, you'll have to keep it in mind. If you go over, I'll let you know. Good evening. Most of you, well, all of you know where you are. You know, most of you actually know the presenter very well, and I don't even have to introduce myself to you. But just for, you know, for formality purposes, I'm David Kramer, the director of the library here at JTS, and we have made it our wonderful custom to sponsor book talks on the part primarily of our faculty and others. And so here we've got this wonderful opportunity to sponsor a talk by, as you all know, Jeff Kress. I just want to say a couple of words of introduction, but most of you know him better than I do, actually. So, you know, I mean...
Some of you are related.
He assures me that most of you have probably not yet read the book. So, you know, he will not be just telling you what you already know, although you may know it for other reasons. But then you can discuss it. And I'm looking forward to the discussion. He's assured me that his presentation will be relatively shorter. We always go from about 7:30 to at the very most 8:30, but the presentation, he says, will be shorter so that the opportunity for discussion will be longer, and given the individuals who are in the room, I just look forward to sitting and listening and witnessing that whole exchange. You know the title of the book, you know its interest in educating for identity in pluralistic Jewish day schools. I'm going to out Hector here. Hector is my assistant in the library. He's been in the library for many, many years, and it is thanks to him that that these book talks are actually possible at all, thanks to his support. When I say I'm going to out him, what I'm going to do is share with you a few words that he shared with me before we headed over here, and that is that he was afraid that he might not enjoy this presentation as much as he does many, because he was concerned that a talk relating to Jewish education would be filled with jargon that he might not know. And I responded and said, well, the good news is that one of the things I noticed in this book was Jeff's remarkable ability to cut through jargon and to really offer things in a very clear and better than clear, even an eye-opening sort of way. And I had marked, even before, Hector, you made that mention, one particular example that's very close to my heart, and there will be other examples in the book that you all will find. He's talking here, this is on page 32, theoretical matters relating to collective identity as opposed to individual identity. And there's a long quotation here from a piece of theoretical writing, which I will not share with you, because while it's clear enough to people who are willing to make through, it is filled with jargon. After the quotation, he offers the following clarification. And I read, so although many people cook dinner regularly, far fewer have a central identity aspect of, self as cook, right? So many people cook, but few people have a central identity as of self as cook. The casual crafter of dinner can be contrasted with someone who has a very elaborate set of elements related to a scheme of self as cook. That might include knowledge, behaviors, affects, and attitudes, and so forth. He goes on, the moment I saw that self as cook, I said, oh, I get it, right? Because I actually identify myself, you know, self as cook, as opposed to someone, you know, who just happens to put dinner together. There are many such examples in here which help in clarification, and so there need be no fear. This is a book which will enlighten all, and I introduce to you my colleague and a colleague of all of yours, Professor Jeff Kress.
Thank you. And I really do appreciate your coming out. I mean, it's wonderful to see like all these faces that I know, and I appreciate that you had other things like eating dinner, going to the Christmas tree lighting. There are many things that could have been done tonight, but instead you're here, and I do appreciate that, each one of you. I'm going to speak for a little while about some of the topics in the book. I'm not going to read from the book because it's late and you don't need any other reason to fall asleep. But I will talk a little bit about the process of how the book came to be. Anything you want to follow up on and hear more about, we can do that. So here's the origins. It all started with a question. The question was one that was posed to me when I first came here to the seminary. Started here about 12 years ago now. And I came from, as most of you know, the world of psychology, clinical psychology, community psychology. And the work I did was in schools, mostly public schools, around how educators can help kids develop positive identities, develop social and positive social relationships, positive emotional intelligence capabilities. So psychology is kind of a preventive rather than a remedial type of endeavor. And I came here to, and I thank Arye, who's sitting here, who had the, it was my honor to come work with Arye, and he brought me here to work on connecting that with Jewish education. How can we help promote pro-social values in a Jewish educational context? So here's a story. I go down to a welcome, a meet and greet. You know, I'm the new guy. It's the first day. You want to meet all the students are there. Everyone's having a little coffee. They ask me what I do. I go into a little spiel, my elevator speech. And afterwards, I keep getting the same question. Oh, do you do informal or formal education? And I had no idea what that meant. So I smiled politely and, you know, came up with some kind of response. And later, what I realized was that I was being asked, do you work in schools or do you work in camps, youth groups, etc.? And that question led me to think about this idea of, well, why is it that if we have a decent theory of development and how people learn, grow, and change, why we have to pigeonhole it in certain settings? Do people learn and grow differently? Yeah, of course, settings are different. A camp is not a school. But what seemed to be missing from the discussion was looking at it from the perspective of the individual who's participating in these experiences. So when I finished kind of being on my soapbox about that, I realized that there was some room to do some research and to articulate some of those ideas. So a little bit of background, this project, the book grew from a research project that was funded by the Avichai Foundation, and my appreciation to them for all of the ongoing support. It started as an evaluation of a professional development seminar for people who were quote-unquote experiential educators in Jewish state high schools. These were people with a variety of job titles. They were called rabbi in residence. They were called director of Jewish life. Some of them were called experiential educator. And the Avichai Foundation had been funding their positions and had been funding their work running Shabbatonim. Shabbatonim are retreats that happen, you would think, always over Shabbat. Oddly, a Shabbaton doesn't necessarily need to happen over Shabbat, I learned. But, you know, so be it. And the Avichai Foundation was saying, if we're funding the Shabbatonim, if we're funding these positions, we should also fund professional development for the people in these positions. And we should evaluate, is this enhancing the Shabbatonim? And that was how I came into this. But it really expanded and what I think, I credit the Avichai Foundation for seeing kind of the bigger picture, that we're not just talking about what makes a good Shabbaton, but we're really thinking about the intersection of two modalities of education, which is experiential education and the world of day schools, which, you know, certainly at that point, and I think I make the argument even now, don't, you know, sometimes are a little like oil and water. They don't always mix as deeply as they can. The methods, I followed this EE experiential education cohort over the course of about 4 years. I or many other people, research assistants, students, etc., observed, there was a total of about maybe 30 Shabbatonim, and there's a little star because most of the material or the juicy stuff from the book is drawn from three schools. These were community, the three focus schools were community day schools, non-denominational. The original project included also Solomon Schechter High Schools. You should know, but it just happens. It doesn't just happen, but I don't want to get into that. You can ask about it. These ended up being, the focus schools ended up being community schools, and those I spent several days observing, interviewing. I observed the Shabbatonim for the schools. I spent several days, being a student, as it were, and just kind of traveling throughout the school. Foundations. This is kind of what I came into it. This is my read of the literature that guided me in this project. I would say it's somewhat, like any lit review, it's more than an assumption that I went in with, but less than a set of facts that I went in with. It's kind of my understanding of things up to that point, maybe a little jargony, but the first is that the goals of Jewish education are holistic. They don't focus on just what you know about Judaism. They go beyond that into a series of emotions, belief, knowledge, behaviors, roles, affiliations, etc., related to Judaism. Your Jewish identity is connected with other identities in certain ways. We use this term Jewish identity. We either like the term Jewish identity or we don't like the term Jewish identity. I can give, if you want to give a long lecture on why we shouldn't use the term Jewish identity, but I do use the term Jewish identity, and I think it has some it has some code value. It's a short way of something, of saying something really long, and this is the really long, and it would be really annoying to have to keep saying that. So as long as we don't get too into like Jewish identity is a thing, like this is a thing, and that it stands for kind of a construct or an idea, I think we're all right. The other foundational idea that I started with was a constructivist approach to identity development, which was it's kind of a Piagetian idea for those who are kind of in that world, which is that our schema or these kind of organized ways that we see the world change as we intersect with the world, as the self and the world intersect. Piaget describes it, our grip changes as we learn how to grip things, as we try to grip different things as an infant. But that's a very basic example of how, obviously identity is a much more complicated process, but if our identity is this, the emotions, beliefs, knowledge, etc., that we take into any experience, as that meets the experience, there's room for, to use the Piagetian terms, either assimilation or accommodation, which might mean either changing the way the identity plays out, coming up with new beliefs, knowledge, behavior, roles, and affiliations, or not, or just reinforcing the ones we already have. That's the idea of assimilation and accommodation from a Piagetian way. And if you look at this as a constructivist idea, basically we're always doing that. My experience tonight will be adapted into the way I see myself as a presenter, as a scholar. It may change the way I see it, or it may reinforce the way I see it, depending on how, depending on the dynamics of my history up to this point, how things go tonight, etc. Education in this way, or education for Jewish identity, involves highlighting challenges to existing identity, or bringing or providing opportunity for the self to become engaged in activities that would cause adaptation. And my colleague of blessed memory, Irv Siegel, my teacher, used the term distancing for this, not as a far away distancing, but distancing in the sense that as educators, we call on individuals to step back, as it were, from held assumptions and beliefs and call those into question in a way, so that we are able to almost distance ourselves from ourself in a way that we could, that our previously held identities come to be called into question. All right, those are the assumptions. A little bit about the schools. the schools I called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Don't know how hard it was to find three schools called Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It was, how many schools did I have to visit? Here's a little bit about them. Here are the facts. What was interesting, and I realize I don't want to talk too long, so I wanted to try to sum up the fact that each one of these schools had a very different feel, or a very different culture, if you use that term. The culture, as I'll write about in the book, or as I did write about in the book, there are a lot of data points. It isn't just like you go there and you see the halls are different and you say, the schools are different. But the halls are kind of, to me, became something of an exemplar of this culture. So the Abraham School almost had a camp feel. It was in a warm climate. There was no building. It was outdoors. I mean, for someone like me who grew up in this area, a school is a building. You don't go, you go outdoors, you get suspended. But this, in between classes, you're outside. And it had that feel to it. As students would move from class to class, there'd be balls being thrown back and forth and, kind of running around. Isaac was a real heavily academic school. I mean, the halls were patrolled, and literally before each period, there's a buzzer. In the 5 minutes before the buzzer, the William Tell Overture would play over the thing, and the administrators would come out and stand in the hall, and everyone would scurry off. You can't make this stuff up. And then Jacob, the halls were, they were in a new building, and the halls were intentionally designed with nooks and spaces for students to have kind of meetings and consultations and small group discussions. And the feel there was kind of a Beit Midrash kind of feel, that people were like using these nooks to interact and study with one another. It's hard to capture this, but I think you get a little bit of the flavor here. And each school does share a lot of characteristics. I mean, there's a kind of tendency when you do this research to write each school as if it's completely different from the other schools. And to some extent, you kind of have to do that to prove a kind of rhetorical point. But, they were all really excellent schools. I'd send my kids to any of these schools. The kids went to great colleges after these, the usual things that they would share. But there were some differences in the flavor and the feel, such as the hall. And being in these schools, even though I was looking specifically at Shabbat Tamim to start with, I went in with this lens of, well, what does it mean to think about experiential education? Or when we asked people the goals of the Shabbatonim, it always came back to, well, building Jewish identity. It came back to this issue of, well, how does that happen in the schools? And it's possible to think about the three schools as exemplars of three different ways that this distancing of identity, this holding up identity against oneself so you could analyze it, but that's too active a word. But you'll see. Let me talk through here. None of this mapping involves pure types. So there are, I'm going to describe a school as X. That doesn't mean that X doesn't happen in one of the other schools. These are, kind of pure, archetypal type of explanations here. So, looking at three different approaches to scaffolding or working or educating around identity development. The first is self-reflective. And that means that the exploration of oneself is driven by opportunities for self-reflection. It's a very obvious kind of rewording of the goal. But the idea is that introspection drives the ability to analyze one's own self. Abraham was the exemplar school there. The school was marked, the environment of the school was marked by a lot of opportunities for kids emoting. I mean, there was a lot of, how do you feel about this? The Drishat Shalom was their, what I'll call the signature pedagogy here. Each senior, at some point, addresses the whole school and talks about their growth while they're at the school. And they shared, I call them blockbuster revelations. I mean, these kids got up there. The hardest time was when, I mean, fill in the blank. You know, my mother became substance addicted and was hospitalized, and then my father had cancer, and then I was had suicidal ideation. I had to be in the hospital, and through this, I worked with this person around it, and it connects to this week's Torah portion. But, you know, the Torah portion always kind of came in at the, very tangentially. It connects to this week's Torah portion because both have letters in them. But the key was this real sense of, you know, I'm going to kind of delve into myself in a mediated way. I mean, the mediated piece, in a sense, is the education here. Behavioral, which is an approach to developing self by taking part in novel experiences. And here, Isaac is an exemplar. The Isaac Shabbatoni, and there were a number of these cases. Isaac was interesting because in terms of their religious approach, they really didn't do a lot of public ritual. This was the heavily academic. And you can imagine, like, we didn't want to take away from the academic piece. And we were pluralistic. We were a community school. You know, but pray on your own time. We had an optional minyan, and, you know, a few kids showed up. When you go to the Shabbaton, there's always dancing and, you know, freilach. It was out of control. To the extent that they were at a camp, literally you thought the floor was going to cave in. I turned to the experiential educator, is this normal? And the answer is, yeah, this is normal. They, the craziest ruachdik, kumzitz at the end, like all of that, which for a lot of these kids was really a foreign way of being Jewish. And the response afterwards was, I never knew it could be like that. This is not like what, you know, this isn't like our shul. And of course, there was follow-up, and there's this question that it raises in the book of to what extent this is, kiruv, or is it really pluralism, or is it trying to bring people in certain ways? I'm not going to address it now, but you can address it if you want. But in a way, the approach was, we're not going to spend a lot of time in school talking about this, but you're going to be doing some crazy stuff which is so out of your realm of experience that it's going to call on you to call some of your practices, beliefs, and Jewish identity into question. And then the third, kind of archetypal approach here is dialogical, which is an approach where the assumption is that you are exploring your own self and your own self schema through your interactions with others. And the third school, Jacob, had all kinds of, this is the Beit Midrash sitting in the hall. This is a school that, it's funny, other people have written about it under other pseudonyms, so it's kind of a weird way to study this thing. But pluralistic dialogue is the mantra there. And the Debate Midrash is a highly structured example of this, where on certain occasions, if there's some kind of policy to discuss or issue that people are dealing with, the student body or faculty or whoever is involved in this will gather, and in a room that's set up, there are chairs here, chairs there, one side will present, the other side will present. You then go and sit on the side that you agree with, and then there's more discussion, and then there's another time, and you'll go and move, and maybe you'll move to a different area that you agree with, and this happens on a regular basis, and is just one of the more striking elements in terms of scaffolding identity. By the way, I mean, when we mentioned pluralism, these also relate to how these schools, which are non-denominational, approach, or at least I don't think they, it may not be in their mission about how they approach it, but I read into how they approach the idea of pluralism, that they, for Abraham, the kind of, they come together, the students come together across denominations around the common ground of emotional self-growth. You know, our denominations are less important if we're talking about how I'm feeling and who I am and how I helped conquer my, addiction or whatever it is. The behavioral issue here was a little more complicated because the kind of modal approach on Shabbaton was orthodox, but the kids were all able to come, kids, adolescents, whatever, were all able to come around. There was no barrier to any of these things. There's no barrier to dancing like a maniac at a Shabbaton, no matter what your denomination was. And here, really, the idea that people came together around was that we should be talking about our differences. And kind of pluralism became, or the dialogue around pluralism became a common, kind of a common pathway for dealing for what brought people together. I mean, oddly enough, talking about how we're different became the unifying theme. All right, so some general comments. The first thing, and this is not a new finding, this is actually similar to Kathy Simon and some of the findings that have been out there, that while there's great potential for any of those three different modes of scaffolding identity to happen in any given class, intentional efforts, and again, what I mean is that educators actually trying to do this. I don't know if the students in class were self-reflecting. I mean, at any given moment, someone could be self-reflective. But a scaffolded, mediated experience, mostly in special activities or experiences. And there were a ton of these things. Shabbatonim. Dramatonim, trips, tikkun olam, it just goes on and on. Assemblies, clubs, the juggling club, the pie eating club. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, these schools had these kind of this list. And what the observation that that came out of this was that. That's great that there are all these activities, but, again, as Kathy Simon and others have pointed out, there's something of a wasted opportunity for not being able to use the class as a time to do this. It also presents issues of continuity. So how do you, if people are thinking about themselves and you're trying to have identity development as a through line in your school, it's not so easy. So, I mean, I was struck, there was, in one of the schools, the kids gathered to do a prayer vigil for a kid who was, I forget, he was sick or injured or something. It was very emotional, and they all gathered, and they did Misha Berach, and they sang the Misha Berach song, and, the friends of the kid were crying, and the bell rings, and then it's back, it's math test. So where is the mediated impact there, and where is that? And that happens again and again. And some of this, as people know from the was it the shopping mall high school? Is that where famous idea that high schools are so segmented that you often don't deal with the same people moment in and moment out? You might have a teacher 45 minutes and then not see them again until the following Thursday or whatever it is. So it led me to ask some questions about, and I'm going to wrap up shortly and we could talk more about this, of day school integration. When we talk about day school integration, we usually talk about it from the point of view of the curriculum. and that is how does the theme of freedom play out in our study of Exodus and in our study of early 19th century America or something like that. I don't know. The social studies teachers will tell you. What I wondered is, what about integration on the part? And there's some assumption that that would then lead to an integrated identity. That somehow hearing it in English and hearing it in Hebrew makes you integrated. I get it, but it led me to think about what if we try to see schools through the viewpoint of these adolescents who are going through it, and who's paying attention to the learner's ongoing construction of self. And I won't get into some of the solutions that schools are using and that I'm thinking about. We could have some discussion of that, but I do think it's a challenge. Last slide, it all started with a question. It's all ending with a few questions. Number one, going back to this idea of informal, and now we'll use the term experiential, we've made some progress in saying, experiential education or informal education can happen in schools. We're good with that. And then you push people and you say, well, what is that? And they go, Shabbatones and the Darfur thing, the rally and Tikkun Olam. And it seems to me that this is just perpetuating what Simon and what I found, what others have found. That what we're saying is that when we're going to treat an educational moment as an opportunity for reflection, for an opportunity for self-growth, we're going to see it as something that doesn't happen in a classroom. And I think that even though we think we've conquered the, experiential education is a modality and doesn't happen in a place, I think we still run the danger of reifying this idea of experiential education and making it something of an other to what could happen in a classroom. And what it got me wondering, and the odd thing about writing a book is that you do the research like 5 years ago, and then the book eventually comes out. So what I've been working on over the last few years is, what if we stop trying to make a big fuss about we need to define experiential education as opposed to any other kind of education, and really just look from a developmental perspective? If we know a little bit about how development takes place, are there goals and active ingredients that can apply to educational experiences in a classroom or out of a classroom? And does it matter whether you're doing a Shabbaton or whether you're doing a lesson about Tanakh or whether you're doing a lesson about social studies? Those things will look very differently. But if we look at, and we can talk about this more, but some of the things I played out in the book are elements from developmental research that lead us to say, this component has to be there. What is it about a Shabbaton or the Debate Midrash or whatever it is that made it so impactful? And why couldn't that happen in the course of a classroom while grappling with Jewish content? That this business of experiential education doesn't have to be an other. And I think that this question has implications for how we structure our schools. It also has implications for how we structure our programs here at the Davidson School and elsewhere around how do we balance the idea that experiential education is something that should be embraced, but also the danger of embracing it too much so that it becomes an other. And how do we embrace experience in a more generative way? So, I think that's it. So, we still have some time. So, if you want to get to the Christmas tree lighting, we can still make it. Who's with me? All right. So, I'll pause for questions. I might have to look at the book because, like I said, I wrote this thing like 5 years ago. So, who remembers?
It's not exactly a question, and forgive me.
Then I won't give you exactly an answer.
No, that's okay, too. It's good. Sharing a thought.
All right.
Since I missed the first 8 minutes, please forgive me if I tread on something that had already been addressed. I could preface it with by saying, well, you could call me an old fogey, but look, my background totally was in secular schools, all right? That's as a start. My Jewish education didn't come until later, and then I immersed myself completely in it. But this is the thought that crosses my mind, because I also have seen it in my professional training in the past, is that it seems like what you're doing is coming up with a theory, if you will, that's au courant. This is what we think for the moment. And this results sometimes in overly drastic situations, both for the school, especially for the students, and everybody else. I agree with having a structured program, but I'm going to go a little back and forth. But what I seem to see at one point is describing what, I guess these are actual schools, but masked, if you will, is that, what are we trying to do? Make our schools what I call the equivalent at NYU of the dormitories, which are now country clubs in a way, that they, I'm talking about NYU, pardon me for the naming, but I will. It's my alma mater.
It's okay. The JTS dorms aren't country clubs.
I'll try to be very short. But the bottom line is that somebody somewhere is forgetting about what you're in school for, and that's education. You can't really develop thoughts, ideas, all that you're talking about without first having, call it rote, but you know, rote education serves a purpose. By getting the rote education, and when you begin to start really experiencing things, especially once you graduate from high school, all right, that's when things begin to come together, that you can put things together, because it's like breathing. Do you have to remember how to breathe in and out every second? No. It becomes automatic, which allows you to breathe without thinking. The same way with education. Get the facts in, and then develop, and be encouraged to develop, both with school and family.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on one... thank you. I want to pick up on one thing that you opened with, which is the... this idea that sometimes we grasp kind of the au courant, like very surface idea of things. And I think that we're at a point as a community of Jewish educators where experiential education is getting to that point where, you know, this idea of making your school more experiential is taking, it has the potential to become a surface change where, you know, basically what it means is, well, we'll have more running around. And, you know, running around is good, but, you know, I agree that what we really need to do is think about how to create developmental experiences that include grappling with Jewish issues and serious Jewish content in a way that creates an experience that engages people in a self-reflective process of identity development. So I think that there's an easy, like, surface way of thinking about experiential education, and I think that it's important that we take that next step. I'm preaching to the choir. I mean, there's, you know, I know like 90% of the people in the room. So, you know, I don't think that there's a great groundswell of we should have surface experiential education. But, you know, unfortunately, I think we can kind of put our finger on that as we look at kind of buzzwords that are circulating around the community. Yeah.
I mean, to kind of come from the opposite direction of you,
okay,
did, I could also make an argument that I could call sitting in math class experiential education.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I could call sitting in a math classroom, having the teacher write equations on the board and walk me through the process of solving them, an experience. I could relate it to an experience that would change the way that I approach things as a teacher in my own professional career, or I could look at it in the perspective of it's the way that I'm learning math. But you could come at it from the perspective that it's all very artsy-fartsy, experiential education-y, or you can come at it from the fact that you can look at any educational setting, any way that it's presented as an experience. And then it's a question of, A, what do we want our teaching styles to be, and how can we really make that math class both a serious learning environment and an experiential thing?
Yeah, I think that's right on. I want to kind of move around, but I think, I mean, take rote learning. I mean, there's rote learning, and the student could walk away from that saying, rote learning, I can't say what I did. And then there's rote learning where, you know, kids could kind of get engaged in that, and it's not just random. I mean, you know, sometimes it's just the learner, and the learner has a short attention or whatever. But, you know, I look you know, I don't want to tell too many stories about my kids because that's always the danger of talking about it again. But, you know, I look at my fourth grade daughter and her peers who they have no problem doing rote education. Why? You know, how is it motivating? They have a beautiful relationship with the teacher. They have wonderful peers that support them, and they make jokes with each other as they're doing it. And they really feel like they're in a community. They know why they're doing it. It builds on strengths that they have. They get to demonstrate at the end because they get to lead services or they get to make a project about it. So it is these teaching methods. You know, there's rote and there's rote. There's rote that we take into account these elements of experience that help facilitate learning and growth, and there's rote that don't, and that's where I think a lot of people get turned off. Yeah, Al?
I was going to respond really quickly.
Go for it.
Your example of mathematics, we experience mathematics with a pen and paper. That's an experience mathematics. So it would be different to integrate experiential education into a topic that would require more experience, like Judaism. We need to live Judaism. Mathematics sort of is two-dimensional by nature.
Right. Unless, of course, we're trying to, for example, look, these are older kids. This is not my fourth grader. But kids figure out real-world problems around using mathematics. This is a problem that occurs to me as someone who lives in suburbia, but I found fascinating and grabbed me, and I looked on the internet. They calculated the minimum number of maneuvers you would need. Sorry, in a parking space. The minimum amount of extra space pre and post your bumpers that a car could get into. You know, if my car is 8 feet long, how many inches more than 8 feet is the minimum that car could get into? Fascinating.
Or less
if you're in New York because you just ripped the bumper out. Now that's not going to motivate my daughter. And it wouldn't motivate me because I don't have to figure it out. But it certainly motivated me to sit and read the report and kind of try to make sense of what was going on. Because as someone who tries to squeeze into parking spaces, it was fascinating. It meant something to me in real life. Mm-hmm. Meredith, you will go over here.
I have two kinds of questions. One is if you could speak a little bit about how these day schools dealt with race. Because I think for me that's one of the big barriers to you know, to make it the frontier or whatever, you know? So, for example, I do lots of, you know, formal writing assignments where students have to write in the eye and reflect on how they're changing as a teacher or how their Jewish identity has motivated them to whatever. And I really have a very hard time grading them because I'm grading someone's personal. And then the other question, which, I don't know, it seems to me you're almost defining anything that's anything that's building identity has to be experiential.
There are probably ways to build identity that are not experiential according to this rubric, but I think as educators, the way we build identity is by facilitating experiences. So I could have, look, at the one hand, the use of the term experience instead of informal is horrible because it's so meaningless. Everything is an experience. You know, I'm in solitude. I, you know, have a white noise machine, so my thoughts are blocked. Is that not an experience because I have no sensory input? It's still an experience. Or reading a book by yourself, it's still an experience. So, you know, what can you not call an experience? But what I'm talking about is the kind of mediated experience that an educator brings to that. So I think that the answer is no, not all identity development happens through interpersonally mediated development with an educator planning that. I can pick up a book and read a book and it can impact on my identity. That's still experiential from the everything's experiential world of things. But I would say it's not the same. It lacks the kind of intentionality of education. You know, I think of it like who's mediating that? That to be education, there's a mediator involved.
So a senior seminar where high school seniors read, you know, 5 texts about what Judaism means, or I don't know, something like that, and then developed what Judaism means to me, which is a class that would get a grade.
Yeah.
Is that experiential education?
Again, I think it's how it's run. I mean, I think it comes, you know, of course it's an experience. Of course it's mediated. But I think then the question is there attention to elements of that experience that would maximize developmental impact? So the fact that you've already named one, which is a reflective component, that you're not just learning, you're reading and then asking, what does it apply to me? Already, I'm saying, all right, that's one of like key components that I think would make up these active ingredients. So, you know, yes, I think you're heading in that direction. But I can imagine that, you know, and look, sometimes it's just being a bad educator. you know, read these things, and I'll tell you how it relates to you as a Jew, and then you'll write that, and I will grade that. Now, that's experiential. Look, it's an experience, because everything's an experience, but I think that it's not experiential in the sense that it motivates self-exploration, because what you're trying to do then is, you know, kind of meet a demand rather than be reflexive on yourself. And the grading question is really, you know, that's a huge question. I mean, what was ironic is that that would come up, that, you know, educators, well, I can't really deviate from the curriculum. The truth is that Judaic studies in most of these schools have such a small kind of grade impact that, you know, all your Judaic studies are aggregated into one grade. I don't know if this is the case. You know, they're all aggregated into one grade, and that one grade is taken into account as in your GPA. So essentially every Judaic studies class is 1/5 of a course or something like that. So yes, there are pressures for grades, but it's not like the grade for your calculus class, which is a 6-credit class and counts twice.
It also undermines the seriousness.
Yes, and it also undermines
that you end up having. This is not something I really have to care about too much because they're driven by the grade.
Right.
So they can all get into a good college.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I wanted to...
Oh, sorry, Sarah. No, come back
just circle back to the... to the empirical work that you did. This question is related to what we've just been talking about, and I don't know if this is something you studied, but I'd be interested in it. You had that slide up before of the differentiation between the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob schools.
This one or the... Yeah.
Yeah. So I was wondering whether you took a look at the... formal academic classrooms, and whether these characteristics were expressed in those classrooms in the formal curricular settings. Like, I know something about the Jacob School. It's been written about and all of that. And I know that they pride themselves, you know, debate midrash is like their signature pedagogy. But that's an out-of-the-classroom thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they also pride themselves on this dialogical thing in the math class and in the Tanakh class and all of that. And I don't know if you saw evidence of that there or at the other places, or maybe you just weren't looking at that because you were focusing on the Shabbat.
No, I did look at that. There was some... you could certainly point to times in, for example, Jacob, where classes were structured that way. But I would say that it wasn't constant. It wasn't, I don't think in any of these schools, you know, you could walk into a class and you might say, this is an Abraham class. Everyone's hugging each other.
Yeah.
But you could also walk into a lot of classes and say, you know, this class could happen anywhere.
That's really interesting. In fact, the Abraham example was, since I don't know that, I can't guess what that school was, I think that I was wondering, Dafka, exactly that, whether if you went into an English class or you know, or particularly in the humanities, you were having that same kind of expressiveness. And given the fact that, let's say, that's not true in general, that really relates back to the thing that you were talking about before. These, like, it's like two separate universes within the school. It's these powerful experiences in these contexts, and then there's classes that you know, chug along like schools always have classes, kind of thing.
What you also saw were like a hybrid, where schools had, I mean, particularly, I mean, less so for Isaac, because it was really an academic focus, yeah. But the other two, they had classes that were specifically structured. They weren't on a content area. They were, let's debate stuff. I mean, that is, they obviously wrote a little bit more in the syllabus. Or, let's sit and talk about ourselves in a class. So, you know, to me, all right, that's kind of a half step in the right direction. Yeah. You know, at least it's called a class, and at least it's a teacher teaching it, so it's bringing that together. And it did seem experiential, but it still, there was an otherness to it. It was something we did kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah, sir.
So, thanks for sharing a lot of really good stuff coming out of this. Here I'm kind of drawing a lot from my own extensive experience working in schools. So you're talking, on the one hand, there's Jewish identity, mm-hmm. and then there's, it seems, more general adolescent identity. And why I think that's important, because if in contemplating how one would highlight or prioritize identity development within a school context, while there are parallels and overlaps in Jewish identity development and general human development, they're not the same. So that would be interesting to investigate how the schools navigate, navigate that. The other piece is the whole sort of conundrum of teachers saying, well, I teach students or I teach content, right? Which is a simplification of the material, of the questions, but I think that some of what you're discussing here, and how do we bring your issues into the formal classroom settings, relates to particular teachers' orientations, and it's important to validate those, because not everybody is homogeneous in their understanding of what they want to do as a teacher and who they want to be as a teacher. So that's the other reason is a very practical one, which is, how would you imagine getting buy-in, getting agreement from a faculty around this? And then furthermore, and I've had this happen often, not related to identity, but related to issues of special needs, how do you educate the teachers in all of this psychology of social development and personality development, in addition to expecting them to be competent in teaching mathematics and science and languages? So the demand on the teacher is enormous.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But it's no more enormous than any other demand you're putting on the teachers. And the answer is there's a literature on that too. And it's slow. I mean, the way you don't do it is by mandating it. The way you don't do it is by having, you know, Thursday afternoon be identity time and having the identity teacher come in. But, I think that this approach, where you're really doing the kind of identity and growth work as part of content, alleviates some of the concern. You're right, not everyone's up for that. And that's, you know, something to deal with as you bring a program into or an initiative into a school. But the first, I used to do this kind of thing full time, go to schools and work before I came here, to work on making change around not Jewish identity, but social development issues. The first thing to work on is this dispelling the idea that working on content and working on kind of identity and social emotional issues are in some kind of temporal negation, that when you're doing one, you're doing the other. Now, that obviously takes a lot of time, and different people are going to come. There's no cookbook to it, other than, you know, people always say, well, it takes 5 to 7 years for a program to be implemented. And that's why, the idea that you could just, you look at the Jacobs School, which, regardless of whether any given math class is dialogical or not, you could feel the difference there than Abraham. That didn't happen overnight. That happened, and it's still happening. They still drag themselves over, are we dialogical enough? Maybe we should have had a meeting about this. And, Abraham is still, oh my God, I can't believe we have a meeting, but we didn't invite these people into the meeting, and how could they have been excluded, and how did they feel about that? There's this constant kind of, that it has to be kept alive. It's not just a vision. It's a vision, but also, real systemic work and real ongoing implementation work. Someone who.
Mine's is very quick. So,
go ahead.
So your study started by having these special people who were the experienced.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So did you sort of not end up deciding that's not the way to go? That day school shouldn't have one experienced person, and it should be more.
No, I think that what they did, kind of in terms of what they really brought was an understanding of the logistics of planning these events, and I think the events were great. But what I think the problem was that the position often became very isolated. It was this one person working in an office over there, and it contributed to the otherness. So I think they should have the people, but I think they should be kind of more integrated into the team. Thanks for coming out. I really do appreciate it.
It's clear that Jeff wants to get to see the tree tonight.
Yeah. Oh, and I do. They sent me this book is like crazy expensive. So if you want, there's a discount that's being offered for people who want to buy the book. So if you want to take a form, I do have. Well, they said they were offering a discount, but they didn't put the discount on here. Didn't they say they were?
Well, I asked Danielle. That's why she told me when they sold that.
All right. So if you want to buy a comic book, let me know, and I'll get it back.
Thank you all for coming, and look for other library book talks.
Thank you, David and Hector, for helping out with
this.
Yes,
this is for the library.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
That's the alarm, apparently.